if he will win. Joe Biden not running and it being Kamala Harris is not exciting, and I don't know that she will win. There's not really excitement. And you guys know that I just, in general, am not super impressed with politicians anyway. They're just people at the end of the day. But there's no one that's exciting me on the Democratic side. On the Republican side, you have the deep, devoted Trump cultists who still are completely on his side. But you also have what the Eggman is describing here. People who believe Trump's time has come and gone, and that Trump will run again due to narcissism and lose. And they don't know who to point to either. And I think this is why Ron DeSantis's name keeps coming up. He's competent in the sense of being able to keep it together. He is Trumpian in a lot of his ideology, and maybe more dangerously effective at being able to get a lot of that stuff done. But it is interesting that other than DeSantis, the people, the names you hear mentioned by the right, like more traditional Republicans, I don't think they have a chance. I think the Republican electorate has moved beyond sort of a traditional Republican at this point in time. And that's why you say, well, if it's got to be Trumpian, but less whacked and maybe younger, that's why the DeSantis possibility keeps coming up. So we're going to wait and see. On today's bonus show, we will talk about Joe Biden's federal contractor vaccine mandate being blocked by a judge. We will talk about the legalization of suicide pods in Switzerland. And we will also talk about the bill backed by progressives in Congress for a four-day work week. What is the chance that this passes? All of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Sign up at...
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
And the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Yo, what's up? DJ's in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
An outrage that the House authorized $768 billion for the military at a time that we're dealing with a pandemic, the risk of climate change, racial and economic injustice, and to do it all in the name of an inflated version of the alleged threat from China just makes no sense.
As the House approves the largest military spending bill since World War II, even after the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, we'll speak with Bill Hartung of the Center for International Policy. Then we'll be talking about a new film, a short film, by Astra Taylor from The Debt Collective. It's called Your Debt is Someone Else's Asset.
The American dream used to be owning your own home. Now it's being debt-free. Altogether, Americans owe a record-breaking $15 trillion and counting. Sold as a lifeline, debt is too often an anchor, dragging people down with compounding interest and fees, pulling wealth and resources from the working class to bloat Wall Street's bottom line.
Then, the invisible wall inside the secretive Libyan prisons that keep migrants out of Europe.
This effort to southernize the European border and to push the southern border of Europe further into Africa is an overall policy from the EU to try to stem the flow of people, desperate people, many of them, attempting to reach Europe.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As COVID-19 cases continue to surge across Europe, North America, and South Africa, a new report finds the world is dangerously unprepared for the next pandemic. Researchers at Johns Hopkins and the Global Health Security Index scored every country on its ability to prevent, detect, and respond to health emergencies. No country scored above 76 on a scale of 1 to 100. This is Sarah Gilbert, one of the creators of the Oxford AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine.
The truth is, the next one could be worse. It could be more contagious or more lethal or both. We cannot allow a situation where we have gone through all we have gone through and then find that the enormous economic losses we have sustained mean that there is still no funding for pandemic preparedness.
On Wednesday, UNICEF warned the coronavirus pandemic has posed the greatest threat to children in 75 years, reversing progress on education, hunger, health care, poverty, abuse, and forced marriage. Here in the United States, the Senate's voted to reverse President Biden's vaccine mandate for larger businesses. Two Democrats, John Tester of Montana and Joe Manchin of West Virginia, sided with all 50 Republican senators to pass the measure. The bill faces an uphill path in the House. If approved, the measure would reverse Biden's order that all businesses with at least 100 workers require them to get vaccinated or undergo regular testing by January 4th. This comes as the number of U.S. residents fully vaccinated against COVID-19 topped 200 million. That's just over 60% of the population. Longtime German Chancellor Angela Merkel officially handed over the reins to Olaf Scholz Wednesday. Scholz of the center-left Social Democrats formed a three-way coalition with the Greens and the liberal Free Democrats after September's election. Scholz vowed continuity with the popular leadership of Merkel. Canada, Britain, and Australia have joined the diplomatic boycott of the Beijing Winter Olympics, citing human rights concerns. This follows confirmation from the White House Monday it will not send any U.S. officials to the Games, though athletes will still participate. The Beijing Olympics kick off February 4th. A warning to our audience, the story contains descriptions of violence, including sexual assault. In Morocco-occupied Western Sahara, renowned Sahrawi human rights defender Sultana Khaya and her sister Luara were attacked and sexually assaulted during a night raid December 5th by dozens of masked agents belonging to the Moroccan security forces who've held the family under house arrest for over a year in the city of Bouchedour. Sultana Khaya says agents stole mobile phones, threw trash, urine, and a noxious black liquid into her family's drinking water storage tank and destroyed what was left of the family's belongings.
We have been subjected to all kinds of injustices by Moroccan occupation, raped, tortured, poisoned, and killed. We urge all free men and women from around the world to intervene in order to save this family and people who have been under occupation since 1975.
Morocco has not issued an arrest warrant for Sultana and Luara, who have been detained since November of 2020 and have suffered multiple sexual assaults and raids to their home. Their arrest has been condemned by Amnesty International and other human rights groups. To see our interview with Sultana Khaya, visit democracynow.org for our exclusive documentary, 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony. French authorities have released a Saudi man who was arrested Tuesday in connection with the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. A prosecutor says the man was arrested at a Paris airport in a case of mistaken identity, since he has the same name as a former member of the Saudi royal guard implicated in Khashoggi's disappearance and killing. In India, authorities are investigating a helicopter crash Wednesday that killed India's Chief of Defense Staff General Bipin Rawat and 12 others. One survivor is in critical condition. The crash occurred in the southern state of Tamil Nadu. President Biden ordered federal vehicles and buildings to start transitioning to renewable energy with a goal of reaching carbon neutrality by 2050. The executive order affects 300,000 buildings and 600,000 cars and trucks. On Capitol Hill, senators grilled Instagram CEO Adam Mosseri on Wednesday amidst damning reports the social app causes widespread mental harm to children and teenagers. Mosseri said Congress should create a body to regulate social media, placing the responsibility for its dangers on the industry at large. Instagram recently halted plans for an app geared towards children, but under questioning, Mosseri would not commit to never developing such an app, saying instead, if created, it would require parental consent. This is Senator Amy Klobuchar.
I think that we are in diametrically opposed goals, the goals of parents out there and the goals of your company. Our kids aren't cash cows, and that is exactly what's been going on. Because when you look at the marketing budget and you look at what your company has done, it's to try to get more and more of them on board.
Instagram is owned by Facebook. The former chief of staff for President Trump Wednesday asked a federal judge to block subpoenas from the House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Mark Meadows' lawsuit came just hours after he refused to appear for a scheduled deposition. Just last week, Meadows had pledged to cooperate with the congressional probe. Committee members said in response they're preparing criminal contempt charges. Meanwhile, a key organizer of the January 6th insurrection that preceded the assault on the Capitol, a key organizer of the rally, has agreed to cooperate with congressional investigators. Ali Alexander pledged to deliver a trove of documents about the so-called Stop the Steal rallies when he's deposed by the January 6th committee today. Lawmakers are especially interested in Alexander's communications with members of Trump's White House and Republican lawmakers. A warning to our viewers, the following stories contain graphic accounts of police violence. In Minnesota, opening arguments got underway Wednesday in the manslaughter trial of former police officer Kim Potter, who says she mistakenly drew her gun instead of her taser when she fatally shot black motorist Dante Wright during a traffic stop in April. During opening remarks, prosecutor Aaron Eldridge said Potter betrayed her badge, failed Dante Wright, failed in her role as the ranking officer at the scene.
Officer Lucky was her trainee, and she was the FTO. So she was the one who determined how this stop would go. She was the 26-year veteran. She was the officer in charge. And it was her job to show Officer Lucky how it's done. And what did she show him? She showed him how to kill someone.
Dante writes, killing in the Minneapolis suburb of Brooklyn Center last April came during the murder trial of George Floyd's killer, Derek Chauvin, and set off a fresh wave of protests against police brutality. California's attorney general said Wednesday he'll investigate the Torrance Police Department after the Los Angeles Times obtained a trove of racist and homophobic text messages exchanged by more than a dozen current and former police officers and recruits. One message contained a caption reading, "Hanging with the homies," under a picture showing several black men who had been lynched. Another message joked about breaking the taillights on the car of a black motorist so police could pull him over and shoot him. The LA Times reports the officers exchanged racist messages for years, a revelation that could affect hundreds of criminal cases in which the officers either testified or made arrests. Three Starbucks locations in Buffalo, New York, could soon be the company's first unionized U.S. shops as votes are counted today in a highly anticipated election. Three other Starbucks stores in Buffalo and one in Mesa, Arizona, have also filed petitions for their own union elections. Meanwhile, Kellogg's workers remain on strike after rejecting a tentative agreement that included a 3% raise. Kellogg said it'll start replacing striking workers with permanent hires. In more labor news, members of the United Auto Workers recently voted in favor of the one-member, one-vote system, which will allow workers to directly elect their president and other leadership. The election reform came after a federal corruption probe, which found UAW leaders were using union funds to make luxury purchases and support lavish lifestyles. And the Senate held a hearing this week focused on Amazon and big tech's role in driving up consumer costs. Senator Elizabeth Warren, who led the hearing, says supply chain issues alone do not give the full picture of the current price surge, blaming corporate anti-competitive practices. Amazon worker Courtney Brown testified about the horrendous worker conditions at her New Jersey warehouse.
Amazon's multi-billion dollar wealth is made possible by offering same-day delivery, and anywhere from same-day delivery to two-day delivery. And the corporation has achieved this speed and scale through their sheer brutality, watching, timing, and punishing associates like me and my coworkers. We are living in a country where machines are getting better treatment than people. The machines at my facility undergo routine maintenance checks to ensure that they don't burn out.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, President Biden may soon vote to approve the largest military spending bill since World War II, with a 5% increase over last year's military spending bill. The $768 billion military budget is $24 billion higher than what Biden requested, despite the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. The package includes funds aimed at countering China's power and to build Ukraine's military strength. It also includes nearly $28 billion in nuclear weapons funding. The bill is headed to the Senate, then to President Biden, after the House approved the bill late Tuesday night, with more Republicans than Democrats voting for it. Among those who voted no was progressive New York Congressmember Jamal Bowman, who tweeted, quote, "It's astounding how quickly Congress moves weapons, but we can't ensure housing, care and justice for our veterans, nor invest in robust jobs programs for districts like mine." Bowman also criticized how the compromise bill strips funding that would have established an office for countering extremism in the Pentagon, saying the bill, quote, "must also protect the black men and women who are disproportionately the target of extremism and a biased military justice system," unquote. Also absent from the bill is a provision to require women to register for the draft. Separately, the Senate voted down a bipartisan bid by Senators Bernie Sanders, Rand Paul and Mike Lee to halt $650 million in U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia amidst the devastating ongoing war on Yemen. For more, we're joined by Bill Hartung, Director of Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy, author of a new report, Arming Repression. U.S. military support for Saudi Arabia, from Trump to Biden. His latest book, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Bill Hartung, welcome back to Democracy Now! First of all, if you can just respond to the House passage of the largest weapons spending bill in U.S. history since World War II.
Well, I think it's an outrage. If you look at what we really need, you know, in the roundup, you talked about the need to spend on pandemic preparedness. The world's on fire with the impacts of climate change. We've got deep problems of racial and economic injustice in this country. We've got an insurrection and violence trying to undermine our democracy. So the last thing we need to do is be throwing more money at the Pentagon. And it's a huge amount. It's more than we spent in Vietnam, the Korean War, the Reagan buildup of the 80s, all throughout the Cold War. And as you said, even at the time as Biden has pulled out U.S. troops from Afghanistan, the Pentagon budget keeps going up and up.
And Bill Hartung, could you respond specifically to the fact that the budget is $24 billion more than what was requested? Is it common to have such a huge difference in terms of the amount requested and the amount granted, $24 billion?
Well, Congress often adds money for pet projects, Boeing aircraft in Missouri, attack submarines in Connecticut and Virginia, but nothing at this level. You know, $24 billion is the biggest congressional add-on that I can think of in recent memory. So it's kind of extraordinary, especially, as we said, when the endless war should be winding down.
And can you talk about some of the key figures in Congress who've been pushing for an increase?
Well, you've got people like Jem Inhofe, who's the Republican lead on the Senate Armed Services Committee, who's basically said we need to spend 3 to 5% more per year in perpetuity, you know, which would push the budget over $1 trillion within 5 to 6 years. He is always touting a report called the National Defense Strategy Commission Report, which was put together primarily by people who were from the arms industry, from think tanks funded by the arms industry. Basically, it was a kind of a special interest collection that were pushing this. And then you have Mike Rogers from Alabama, who's the key player on House Armed Services. He's got Huntsville in his state. And Huntsville is sort of the missile capital of America, Army missiles, missile defense systems. He also gets hundreds of thousands of dollars in the weapons industry for his reelection. So there's a strong kind of pork barrel special interest push by the military-industrial complex that helped bring about this result.
The Senate voted down a bipartisan bid by Senators Bernie Sanders, Rand Paul and Mike Lee to halt the $650 million in U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia. This amidst the devastating ongoing war on Yemen. I want to play a clip of Senators Paul and Sanders addressing the Senate Tuesday.
The U.S. should end all arms sales to the Saudis until they end their blockade of Yemen. President Biden said he would change the Trump policy of supporting Saudi's war in Yemen. But it's not all that apparent that policy has changed. We commissioned these weapons, and we should not give them to countries who are starving children and are committing essentially genocide in Yemen.
President, I find myself in the somewhat uncomfortable and unusual position of agreeing with Senator Paul.
So that was Senator Sanders and Paul. Bill Hartung, you're the author of the new report headlined Arming Repression, U.S. Military Support for Saudi Arabia from Trump to Biden. Can you talk about the significance of this? What was voted down?
Well, these missiles are air-to-air missiles, which can be used to enforce the air blockade that's been put over Yemen. So the Saudis have bombed the Sana'a airport runways. They've tried to keep ships from coming in with fuel. And as a result, costs of medical supplies now are out of the reach of the average person of Yemen. People haven't been able to leave the country for medical treatment. Norwegian Refugee Council and CARE say 32,000 people have probably died just for lack of being able to leave the country for that specialized care. 400,000 children are at risk, according to the World Food Program, of starvation because of the blockade. Millions of Yemenis
need humanitarian aid just to survive, and the Saudi blockade is making it increasingly difficult to get that aid or to get commercial goods that they need. So basically, this is a criminal enterprise run by Mohammed bin Salman, and Joe Biden said when he was a candidate, Saudi Arabia would treat it like a pariah. He wouldn't arm them. In his first foreign policy speech, he said the U.S. would stop support for offensive operations in Yemen. And yet he's approved a contract for maintenance of Saudi planes and attack helicopters, and now this deal for the missiles. So he's basically gone back on his pledge to forge a new relationship with Saudi Arabia and to use U.S. leverage to end the blockade and the war itself.
Bill, before we conclude, just to go back to the military budget, could you comment specifically on the $28 billion earmarked for nuclear weapons?
Well, unfortunately, this bill doubles down on the Pentagon's buildup of a new generation of nuclear weapons, a new generation of nuclear warheads, which is, of course, the last thing we need at a time of global tensions. In particular, there was even a provision that said it's not allowed to reduce the number of intercontinental ballistic missiles, which are the most dangerous weapons in the world because they could easily be used by accident if there were a false alarm of attack, because the president has only minutes to decide whether to use these things. So I think that's one of the biggest stains on this bill, is basically continuing to stoke the nuclear arms race, not only at great cost, but at great risk to the future of the planet.
And finally, the China and Russia being used as justification for weapons sales and increased military budget. Can you compare the U.S. military budget to theirs?
Well, the U.S. spends about 10 times what Russia spends, about 3 times what China spends. It has 13 times as many active nuclear warheads in its stockpile as China does. We've got 11 aircraft carriers of a type that China doesn't have. We've got 800 U.S. military bases around the globe, while China has 3. So this whole idea that China and Russia are military threats to the United States has primarily been manufactured to jump up the military budget. And so far, unfortunately, at least in the halls of Congress and the Biden administration, that's been successful.
Bill Hartung, I want to thank you for being with us, director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. We'll link to your new report, Arming Repression, U.S. Military Support for Saudi Arabia from Trump to Biden. Hartung's latest book, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Next up, calls are growing for President Biden to extend the moratorium on student debt payments as millions face a debt crisis during the pandemic. We'll speak with the debt collective's Astra Taylor about her new animated film, Your Debt is Someone Else's Asset. Stay with us.
Let me tell you what I've been through when it come to Sally. She called me at least twice a day. She want our money badly. Calling me from different numbers. Ooh, she thinks she's slick. But I got them all memorized. I hit ignore quick. Needed tuition. Needed room and board. Had to pay for books. So I took out loans to feed the board. Graduated. Wasn't making quite enough to pay them back. Went in default. Messed my credit up. Check my Equifax. I ain't proud of that, I'm more proud of that, I ain't drowning that. I got 2 jobs, really got on my grind, no time to whine. I can't ride the pine in the game right now, my time to shine. Started paying them loans back one at a time. Got them down, 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 till I paid them all off. Peace sign. For those who doubted me, yeah, this is payback. And I've been on my grizzly, yeah, since way back. No sir, and I don't drive a Maybach. But guess what I did? I finished paying selling Maybach, Maybach. I finished paying selling.
Sally Maybach by D1 here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Rights groups and lawmakers are calling on the Biden administration to extend the moratorium on student loan payments that's been in place since the pandemic started. The Biden administration announced in August it would extend the pause for about 42 million people, but that extension is set to end in less than 2 months, on January 31st, 2022, even as many continue to struggle during the pandemic. On Wednesday, 200 groups, led led by the Student Borrower Protection Center, sent a letter to Biden saying, quote, there is a broad consensus among borrowers, advocates, industry regulators, enforcement officials, and lawmakers that a rush to resume student loan payments is a recipe for disaster and will result in widespread confusion and distress for student loan borrowers. Also this week, a group of 14 lawmakers led by Senator Raphael Warnock of Georgia called on Biden to waive the interest on student loans even after payment collection resumes, writing, quote, accumulating student loan interest can be a daunting challenge for borrowers with the lowest incomes or the heaviest student debt burdens, unquote. They noted the debt crisis has also disproportionately impacted Black, Latinx, and Native communities. During his campaign, Biden vowed to cancel federal student loan debt and fix the broken student loan system. But his administration has said the extension pausing payments through next January would be the final one. For more on the debt crisis, we'll be joined in a minute by Astra Taylor, co-founder of The Debt Collective, a union for debtors. But first, I want to turn to her new animated short film she's publishing today at The Intercept with illustrations by artist Molly Crabapple called Your Debt is Someone Else's Asset.
The American dream used to be owning your own home. Now it's being debt-free. Altogether, Americans owe a record-breaking $15 trillion and counting. Sold as a lifeline, debt is too often an anchor, dragging people down with compounding interest and fees, pulling wealth and resources from the working class to bloat Wall Street's bottom line. Every debt we hold is someone else's asset, with our monthly payments providing steady revenue streams for greedy creditors. Households with credit card debt pay around $1,155 a year in interest alone. Americans now die owing an average of $62,000, much of it credit card debt. A significant amount of the $770 billion of credit card debt sloshing around is medical bills, ambulance rides, doctor's visits, and surgeries paid for with the swipe of a little plastic card. Then there's the additional $140 billion of medical debt and collections, combined with an estimated $50 billion in back rent and $1.4 trillion in auto loans. Much of this debt didn't exist a few generations ago. Consider the $1.8 trillion in student loans this country now holds, which wasn't a problem in the 1960s when college was often free, or close to it. Ronald Reagan helped change that. He made his name by demonizing protesters on the University of Berkeley campus. In 1967, as governor of California, he pushed the university system to start charging students tuition so they would, quote, think twice about whether they wanted to pay to carry a picket sign. During his career as senator, Joe Biden advanced Reagan's project, working to expand student lending. As a senator from Delaware, the credit card industry capital, Biden was a devoted servant of the financial sector. He fought relentlessly for 2005 legislation that weakened borrower protections and made bankruptcy more difficult for regular borrowers, strengthening the hand of the student loan and credit card industries and helping cause a wave of home foreclosures. But debt is not just about money. It's about power. Debt has long been both a source of profit and a tool of social control and racial domination. The founding fathers knew this. Thomas Jefferson argued that debt should be canceled after natural limits, which he took to be about a generation, but only for white men like himself. In 1803, he wrote that debt should be used as a weapon against indigenous people to steal their territory. We shall be glad to see the good and influential individuals among them run in debt, because we observe that when these debts get beyond what the individuals can pay, they become willing to lop them off by a cession of lands. Sharecropping, redlining, predatory lending all continued this trend, deepening racial inequities. As a result of the 2008 mortgage crisis, Black and brown families lost upwards of 50% of their collective wealth. For regular debtors, even a late payment can spell disaster. A tanked credit score can make it impossible to rent an apartment or get a job. Default on your student loans? The government can seize your wages, tax refunds, and Social Security. Debtors' prisons are technically unconstitutional, but in practice, people struggling to pay medical bills or court fees can wind up in jail. But not all debtors are treated so cruelly. Rich people regularly walk away from their obligations, and companies engage in strategic defaults. The banks that crashed the economy in 2008, they got bailed out. Donald Trump, the self-professed king of debt, left a string of corporate bankruptcies in his wake. And don't forget that during the COVID pandemic, the federal government spent hundreds of billions of dollars buying up bad corporate debt belonging to entities including Exxon and Walmart, and offering companies, including payday lenders, forgivable loans. It's time regular debtors got a break, too. It's time for a jubilee, the erasure of debts and a rebalancing of power between regular people and elites. It's not a new idea. Jubilee was described in the Bible, and many ancient civilizations had periodic jubilees to avert social and economic collapse. Our earliest recorded histories are stone tablets inscribed with credit ledgers. Nearly as long as debt has existed, debt cancellation has existed too. Throughout history, debtors have risen up to demand relief. In the early 6th century BCE, a debtors' riot helped nudge ancient Athens towards democracy. The reforms, known as the shaking off of burdens, included debt absolution and an end to debt bondage. Something similar happened in ancient Rome after debtors mounted the world's first general strike. In the United States, indebted workers and farmers revolted in the colonial era, and then again during the Great Depression. Later, the call for debt cancellation rang out at Occupy Wall Street. In recent years, striking debtors helped force the government to cancel billions of dollars in student loans. Abolishing medical debt, back rent, and student loans would free up money now spent on debt servicing for other things. People could buy homes and start families, and the racial wealth gap would narrow. Research estimates that canceling student debt alone would boost the economy by up to $108 billion a year and create 1 million jobs. Under pressure from activists, President Biden campaigned on a promise to cancel an immediate minimum of $10,000 of student debt per borrower. Thanks to the Higher Education Act of 1965, he has the power to cancel all federal student loans. With a single signature on an executive order, President Biden can free people from student debt, giving tens of millions of people their lives and futures back. Now, we need to make him do it, and much more. We deserve nothing less than a jubilee.
That's the new animated short film, Your Debt is Someone Else's Asset, published today at The Intercept with illustrations, remarkable illustrations by the artist Molly Crabapple, narrated by Astra Taylor, who joins us now. Writer, filmmaker, co-founder of The Debt Collective, a union for debtors. Her latest book is Remake the World, Essays, Reflections, Rebellions. Astra, welcome back to Democracy Now! What a film. And kudos to Molly Crabapple. She is just a stunning illustrator and artist. If you can just start off with the title, Your Debt is Someone Else's Asset. Talk more about why you're releasing this today and what that means.
Thank you so much for having me on and for premiering the film. And absolutely, Molly and her team, Kim Bookbinder and Jim Blatt, did an amazing job. Your Debt is Someone Else's Asset. One of the powers of animation is that it allows us to make something visible that we can't normally see. So much of debt, you know, is invisible. And one thing this film shows is it shows debtors, but it also follows the chains of debt back to the people who hold our debts as assets. The people that we pay monthly, who collect the interest and fees, you know, who are essentially the 1%. These debt payments are a form of wealth transfer from the poor to the rich. And so this film, one thing it does in a playful but really serious style is show that. So there's lots of evidence that debt is accelerating inequality. It's compounding racial inequities, you know, because, again, these are these debts that weigh us down are somebody else's investments. And they're very, very, very invested in protecting those assets.
Astra Taylor, I mean, the figure that you give, a record-breaking $15 trillion of debt. Can you provide some sense, some explanation of how the U.S. got to this point, $15 trillion?
Well, as this film shows, you know, in less than seven minutes, we travel through thousands of years. So debt is older than capitalism. Debt is really ancient. But there's something about the form of capitalism we live under where debt is really central. So we can, for example, think back to the 1970s. You know, much of this debt, as I say in the animation, didn't exist a few generations ago. Well, what's happened? Wages have stagnated. Regulations on the financial sector have been rolled back. They rolled back usury limits, so limits on how much interest can be collected. So what's happened is that people have essentially been forced to borrow. People don't live beyond their means. They're denied the means to live. So working people are robbed twice. You're underpaid at the job, and then you're charged interest because you're having to borrow student loans to get an education. You're having to go into debt for medical care. You're having to take out a payday loan or a credit card to put food on the table. So debt has absolutely exploded. That $15 trillion is mortgage debt for people. We have to go into debt to procure housing. $770 billion of credit card debt. As I say in the film, a lot of that is medical debt because people don't have adequate health care in this country. If you have universal health care, medical debt doesn't exist. So this is absolutely a problem that isn't just intrinsic to human existence. It's a consequence of political and economic choices. And as this situation has evolved, creditors, the financial sector, have amassed more and more power over Washington. And that's why it's so important to tell the economic story and the political story side by side, as this film does.
Astra, one of the things that's very striking and, of course, also disturbing in the film is the fact that you say that Americans on average now, when they die, owe $62,000 in debt. Can you explain what happens to this debt after someone passes away? Is it erased or is it passed on to the next generation?
Yes, $62,000 of debt. That is an immense amount. So not all of it is literally passed on to people's family and heirs, but what it does is it impedes families' ability to build intergenerational wealth. So what we have is some people who have assets building intergenerational wealth, and others, you know, who are never able to do that. They're never able to get ahead. So this is particularly true. We see this with the racial wealth gap in this country, which is for the median households about 10 to 1. For families who have student debt, the racial wealth gap between Black and white families swells to 20 to 1. So this is, it impedes people's ability to build wealth and to thrive. And it also underscores, I think, that powerful image of a coffin underwater with that number on it just underscores the fact that debt is a matter of life and death for people. We're seeing this right now as the Biden administration is threatening to turn on student loan payments January 31st. We're seeing debtors that are just absolutely not ready for that. People who are overwhelmed with anxiety, making them, compounding their stress. You know, we're just seeing that this is something that is really serious for people. And I think that illustration really drives that point home.
And you say that President Biden could wipe out the debt with his signature. Can you talk about the role he's played in expanding both student and credit card debt and what power he has right now?
Yes, as the animation shows, you know, Biden is part of a long line of American presidents who have sided with creditors. I mean, we have what some scholars call a creditor's constitution. The struggle between debtors and creditors is really essential to the founding of this country. But Biden has played a really significant role as the former senator from Delaware, which is the credit card capital of the world. So he was absolutely instrumental in passing 2005 bankruptcy reform, which was, you know, something the credit card industry really wanted. It repealed bankruptcy protections for student debtors with private loans. So he has been on the wrong side of this. That said, because of organizing, because of the group, the Debt Collective, which I founded, I organized with, and other activists, you know, he was forced to run on a promise of $10,000 across the board debt relief and even more for students from certain colleges. And he has the authority. We know this, the very same authority that Donald Trump used to do this student loan payment pause is the authority that President Biden can use to cancel all federal student debt, not just 10,000, not just 50,000, but all of it. And it's absolutely a moral imperative that he does it. A recent study showed that 90% of fully employed student debtors are not financially secure enough for the payments to go back on. And it will boost the economy. It will have all of these beneficial effects. It will narrow that racial wealth gap I mentioned from 20 to 1 for borrowers to 3 to 1 between black and white households. And so we're organizing for that. The Debt Collective is calling for a week of action with an action in D.C. January 18th. We have to push him and make him do it, just like the film says.
And who does get bailed out? I mean, it's not like, well, we just can't afford to wipe out these debts. Talk about the payday loan operators, the large corporations.
We can't afford not to wipe out these debts. Again, if we have a jubilee, we, the 99%, will all be richer as a result. There are so many benefits to this. But a jubilee, as you pointed out here, you know, is not a pie in the sky idea. Debt cancellation happens all the time. It just happens for wealthy individuals and for corporations. Those companies who have the lawyers who advise them on their strategic defaults, the banks that can get bailed out after 2008. So what we saw in 2020 when the coronavirus hit was the government stepping in a massive way, buying up hundreds of billions of dollars of bad corporate debt belonging to the biggest companies in the country, offering payday lenders and other creditors forgivable loans. You know, we need to extend this mercy, this generosity to debtors who have not done anything wrong. People are in debt by design. This is a system that gives people no other options for making ends meet. That's what happens when you have a country with a minimum wage of $7.25. So jubilee is possible and it's necessary, and debtors need to fight for it.
Astra Taylor, we want to thank you so much for being with us, writer, filmmaker, and co-founder of the Debt Collective, a union for debtors. Latest book, Remake the World, Essays, Reflections, Rebellions. Co-writer and narrator of the new animated short film that we've just premiered, Your Debt is Someone Else's Asset. Next up, we look at the invisible wall inside the secretive Libyan prisons that keep migrants out of Europe. Stay with us. I See Everything by Ian Sweet. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We end today's show looking at a shocking report in the New Yorker magazine that looks at how the European Union has created a shadow immigration system that captures migrants arriving from Africa before they reach Europe and sends them to brutal detention centers in Libya run by militias. This comes after video obtained by CNN as long ago as 2017 showed captured migrants in Libya being sold at a modern-day slave auction. The new article is titled "The Invisible Wall Inside the Secretive Libyan Prisons That Keep Migrants Out of Europe." For more, we're joined by its author, Ian Urbina, investigative journalist, director of the Outlaw Ocean Project. Ian, your piece follows in particular the tragic story of a 28-year-old farmer and father of three who'd fled his failing farm in Guinea-Bissau. He wanted to reach Europe. His name is Aliou Kande. Can you lay out what you found out about his life and his death?
Sure. So Aliou, as you said, was in many ways a quintessential climate migrant. He had struggled for quite some time on his farm in Guinea-Bissau, which is a small, very poor Western African country. Two of his brothers had already made this trip to Europe. One had arrived to Italy, the other to Spain. And Aliyu, as you know, his farm couldn't produce and the droughts and monsoon, you know, rains got worse, decided he would make the same journey himself. He made his way from Guinea-Bissau through the Saharan Desert, a fairly perilous journey, and ultimately arrived, as many migrants do, to Libya as the best sort of launching point, the closest launching spot for rafts to Europe. He bought his way onto a trafficker's boat and made it out about halfway across, about 20 hours out to sea outside of Libyan waters. And the EU-funded so-called Libyan Coast Guard captured him and about 100 other migrants there and returned them to shore, where they were put in one of these detention centers.
Ian, could you explain the origins of this Libyan Coast Guard? What is their mandate, and what did you learn about what they actually do at sea?
You know, the Libyan Coast Guard, I think, is best thought of in a sort of metaphoric or broader way. If you think of what's happening on the Mediterranean as a war on migration, it's an EU-led war on migration. You know, that war has three armed forces, an air force, a navy, and an army. So the Air Force is called Frontex, and Frontex is the EU border agency. And Frontex puts planes and drones over the Mediterranean with the sole purpose of spotting and looking for migrant rafts that are trying to reach Europe. And they report that intelligence ultimately to the Libyans. The Navy in this war, if you will, is the Libyan Coast Guard. This is a wholly EU-created, EU-trained, equipped, armed force. As different from most coast guards, which face inward towards shore, which face outward towards shore, normally protecting a coastline from outside threats, the Libyan Coast Guard faces inward because actually what they're doing is trying to protect Europe from migrants aiming to reach there. And the Libyan Coast Guard's primary aim is to catch migrants before they reach European shores. And then the army in this war, if you will, the on-land force in the war is the Gulag that exists in Libya, a sort of grid of about a dozen to two dozen detention centers that are, you know, militia-run, many of them EU-funded indirectly, that hold all these migrants and attempt to return them back the other direction.
Ian, you mentioned that the Gulag, one of the detention facilities that you focus on is called Al-Mabani, which initially you'd been told by Libyan authorities you would have permission to enter, but of course that didn't happen. Can you explain? I mean, this is a place where international human rights organizations have documented the most brutal abuse. You didn't get into the facility, but you were able to get footage of what was going on inside. Can you talk about that? What did you find?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, Al-Mabani is one of about a dozen official detention centers. These are all militia run, but they are under the auspices of the UN-recognized federal government. These facilities, and Al-Mabani in particular, which is the biggest, newest, and most notorious, are typically warehouses that have been converted into armed compounds. Al-Mabani is a place that, you know, in normal times may hold, 2,000 migrants. More recently, due to recent raids of a migrant neighborhood in Tripoli, you know, Al-Mabani surged to about 5,000-6,000. And as you mentioned, you know, what aid workers are, what Western and non-Western aid groups that are able to get into these facilities, Al-Mabani included, what's routinely documented is extortion, rape, torture, and sometimes murder. What we were investigating in particular was a particularly egregious murder in which guards opened fire on migrants, and Aliyu Kande, our main character, was killed.
I wanted to turn to another migrant. This is a clip of a migrant from Guinea named Suleiman. In April, he was rescued from a rubber boat by Ocean Viking along with 235 people. Here, Suleiman describes the previous treatment he received from Libyan authorities.
The Libyan boat, they came and it capsized the boat. I was shouting, "Mom, Mom, I'm going to die." I don't know if you can imagine, but the Libyans came and instead of saving us, as we were dying, they started to take pictures. Pictures first. After that, they sent a small boat, they picked up people while insulting and beating us up.
And now I want to turn to a clip of a young Togolese man who was rescued by the Ocean Viking describing the treatment of black migrants in Libya. He spoke in July.
Even when you are not in prison, you are in prison in Libya. If you're black, you're in prison. You may be in the city, but you're in prison because something could happen at any minute. For example, you could take a taxi. They take you where you're not going. They lock the doors and call and say, "We have a fluze." That means a blackie wants to sell. He wants to sell you. He shows you a gun. You can do nothing against a gun. It's like that.
So, Ian Urbina, if you can talk more about these migrants who were saved, and then also talk about examples of intelligence shared by the European Union with Libya regarding immigration policy.
I think that quite rightly, it's important to point out, as you just did, that the rhetoric around the mission on the Mediterranean that the EU pushes forward is that the Libyan Coast Guard is funded by them because they're engaged in rescues. It's utterly misleading. These are arrests. Most migrants, the vast majority of migrants, desperately do not want to be stopped and taken by the Libyan Coast Guard. Libyan Coast Guard routinely opens fire on the migrant boats. And quite often, these boats are in international waters, not even in Libyan national waters. Those arrests, not rescues, result in these migrants being taken back to shore. Your second question, you know, the Libyan intelligence being shared, Frontex intelligence, border authority intelligence being shared with Libyans has been extremely well documented. It's a routine occurrence. And it's really the only way that the Libyan Coast Guard is able to find these migrant boats on the Mediterranean is because the drones, which we documented on film, and the planes that fly overhead spot them first. And then they call that in usually to the Italian government. The Italian government alerts the Libyan Coast Guard with the coordinates, and then the Libyan Coast Guard goes and picks the boats up. Sometimes, as your recording mentioned, attempting to capsize them, opening fire on them. And if that is not the chosen method of the day, then they arrest them, beat them, bring them on shore, and return them to shore.
Ian, could you also talk about the really staggering scale of this crisis? You cite in your New Yorker piece figures from the International Organization for Migration, the IOM, saying the Coast Guard and other Libyan authorities have intercepted more than 80,000 migrants just in the last 4 years. You also say, again citing the IOM, that in just the first 7 months of this year, more than 15,000 migrants were captured by the Coast Guard. But by the end of those 7 months, only about 6,000 were in detention facilities. So could you explain what you found out about where the remaining migrants were taken and whether it ever happens that the Libyan Coast Guard or Libyan authorities simply deport the migrants back to their countries of origin, or what happens to them?
Yeah, I mean, so there are a bunch of questions there, so let me try to roll through them. I mean, one on the issue of scale, I mean, this is really important to bear in mind. This is a climate migration story, and we're looking at, in the next 50 years, 150 million people seeking out of desperation, typically, to move elsewhere. And so the policy of the EU of outsourcing migration control to a failed state, namely Libya, not unlike what the U.S. government is doing in Mexico, is a really doomed strategy and is only going to get more perilous as more waves of people start trying to reach safer places. With regard to the gap in numbers, there is this really worrisome issue, which you point out, which is there are two places where there's data. One is when all these people are captured and brought to shore in Libya, they're tallied, you know, by EU-funded, you know, tablets and workers in the port. So we have statistics on those numbers. They're then put on buses and taken to the prisons, and they're handed over to the Libyans. The next number you have is a rough estimate month by month from the Libyan government of how many people are in detention. There's a huge gap there between the numbers, those that arrived ashore and those that officially arrived to the prisons. Where do the other folks go? Those folks are probably taken to, quote unquote, unofficial sites, unofficial detention centers, which are even more brutal and awful than the official ones, and where these issues of extortion, both in official and unofficial sites, i.e. squeezing the migrants, handing them a cell phone, saying, look, you need to call someone, have them wire to this account $500, and that's your ticket out. Extortion is the sort of business model in the official and unofficial sites. That's most likely what's happening in both locations. Those that don't show up either go to unofficial sites, are dumped at the border with Niger, some of them. Others are shipped out for forced labor on agricultural or construction sites. And some are dumped into Gargaresh, which is a migrant a neighborhood in Tripoli. And those are the lucky ones.
So you mentioned Niger. You reported that in 2015, the European Union pressured Niger to adopt a statute called Law 36. If you can explain what that is and then what the alternative is, and that goes to your own organization, the Outlaw Ocean Project.
Law 36 was in some ways a perfect illustration of the broader policy here and one that's really problematic, the broader policy of trying to stem the flow of people from places of desperation to places of less desperation. And so the EU, you know, look, in 2015, there were 500,000 migrants that crossed the Mediterranean. So there was a serious crisis in how to deal with so many people arriving to Italy, Greece, Spain. So the EU decided, look, we've got to sort of choke that off further upstream. And Law 36 is a perfect example of what was done. You had this long sort of policy of open borders in these countries and a sort of steady and established and legal and in many ways healthy flow of people through the Saharan Desert on one main road, primarily through Agadez. And overnight, what, you know, bus drivers turned into traffickers because there was this law, EU-led, EU-instilled law called Law 36 that made it illegal to cross those borders or to carry those people. And that was part of the larger agenda of trying to stop the flow. What are the solutions here? Not an easy question to answer. One solution surely is for wealthy Western nations, be it the US or the EU, to definitely not outsource migration policy to failed states. That's certainly the first thing that should happen. In Libya, specifically with the EU, what I hear from smart folks who work on these issues is that if they wanted to try to clean up and lessen the harm and abuse that are occurring quite immediately in Libyan detention centers, the way to squeeze the Libyan government, which again, Libya is a state that is in, you know, a state in name only. If they wanted to try to clean up the prisons, then they could squeeze the Libyan government through the Libyan Coast Guard, since it's entirely funded by the EU, and say, look, if you want more of our assistance, then, you know, you have to immediately open the doors of the detention centers, let observers in, raise the standards, stop the abuses. That's a short-term pragmatic goal. But the deeper goal is there needs to be more funding to slow and more policy to slow the outflow of desperate people from their place of origin.
Well, we want to thank you for being with us, Ian Urbina, investigative journalist, director of the Outlaw Ocean Project. His recent article in the December issue of The New Yorker is titled "The Invisible Wall Inside the Secretive Libyan Prisons That Keep Migrants Out of Europe." We'll link to his project on our website at democracynow.org. And again, if you'd like to join us for our 25th anniversary celebration that we had the other night, you can just go to democracynow.org and see our interviews with Noam Chomsky and Angela Davis, with Winona LaDuke and the National Book Award-winning poet Martina Spada, the performances by Lila Downs and Tom Morello, and appearances by Danny DeVito and Danny Glover and Cornel West. That's at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
It for people is my dad shot himself and the bullet hit everyone in his life. It was a week before my 30th birthday and I had this impulse to call him, but I didn't because I thought I could call him later that week.
63 Americans a day die by gun suicide. With safe gun storage, we can give our loved ones a second chance at life. Learn more at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by Brady and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Melinda Crawford, a Scottish fiddler, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Everybody ready?
Hey there, everybody.
It's time for Whiskey Before Breakfast, right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark, Delaware, WUTC and WUTC HD1 Chattanooga, Tennessee, WKYWLP Kaiser, West Virginia, or Tube City Online Radio from McKeesport, Pennsylvania at WMCK.FM. I'm Amanda Richard, and I've got a show that I know you will enjoy. So stick around. We start off on the liquored up side of the family. We close down on the gospel side of the family. And in between, you'll hear an eclectic mix of folk music that, as I said, I know you will enjoy. So let's start off our liquored up set by going to the old time side of the family. Here come the Morgantown Rounders. They're going to dance all night with a bottle in your hand.
Ain't seen nothing of my job long since. So walk on home, couldn't get along. Here comes Sally with the pigtails on. She took it off and I put it on. Here comes Sally with the red dress on.